Let's bless the Lord together by looking at His Word as it resonates again in our hearts from the book of Exodus. We continue our series, and I am quite aware that it is Christmas time, just in case you were wondering. But I think you'll see God's good gifts to us in a fresh way as we continue to look at His Word. We'll do Exodus 35 today, chapter 34, verse 35. That's the text. Next week, Will Peterson will be preaching for us his final message in his series on Romans as he prepares to go out to plant the church in Estero in January. So I'm happy to have him preach next week. And I'll have the opportunity to preach at our church plant in Orange Tree that same day. So it's really cool to see what God's doing in our midst. And then things will be back to normal the week after that. But so honored to see what God's doing in our midst as a church, through our church, and most importantly, through His Word. So let's look at Exodus 33 as we resume our story from last week. I'm just going to begin our time in verses 7 through 11, and I'll read the remainder of the text as we work our way through the sermon. Now Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would rise up, and each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he had gone into the tent. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship each at his tent door. Thus, the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses turned again into the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Previously, in our study of Exodus, we began the first part of two, in which we discovered, in a rather long, drawn-out, slightly painful way, of the ugliness of our own idolatry against God. I warned you last week that you would not necessarily like how the message concludes. It would not resonate with your heart too much. But that the next episode in the series, the second half of the movie, was coming. And this is that half. For those of you who weren't here, you'd probably be wondering, well, what would be so dissatisfying about last week? What was so disappointing? Well, you kind of see it a little bit in the passage we just read, but I think you see it the most in the verses before it. Basically, what had happened is God had entered into a marriage-type ceremony with His people, called a covenant. And while they were finalizing the details of this with Moses at the top of the mountain, the people themselves had actually committed adultery. It was the equivalent of infidelity on the honeymoon. They were within 40 days of making this agreement with God, and they had already prostituted themselves, as the text will later say, to another god, or at least worshiping and celebrating this god in a new way that He had forbidden, a way that He did not like. And so we saw God's wrath burn hot against His people, and that's disappointing. That doesn't give you like the warm fuzzies on the inside. And you think that, okay, there's going to be a great resolution here, and there is some resolution. Moses, as an effective intercessor, as a relationship broker, like rightly represents God to the people, and he pours out some punishment on them. And Moses also, as a true broker would, represents the people to God. And God keeps his hand of absolute punishment from falling upon them. Basically, what he said was he was going to wipe them all out and start over with Moses. And in his mercy, he relented and punished them some. But still, at the end of the story, says, you guys can go ahead to the promised land. But here was the really dissatisfying part. But you're going to do it without me. I'm not going with you. This wasn't just disappointing, friends. This was the end of the road for them. It says that their hearts like were hurting at this word that God would not go with them. In fact, they were commanded to mourn. They were in the state of like relational confusion. And while we walked out last week being able to say, thank God for his mercy, I'm still glad I'm here, I don't think that most of us are really satisfied with wanting to know that God merely tolerates our existence. That's not enough for most of us. The fact that he just like lets us off the hook for a little while and our relationship with him is somehow unknown. And so stories like this are written. They're written to identify with those of us who feel in our hearts at times that God may be tolerating us, but not necessarily treasuring us. I mean, this is amazing narrative. I mean, can you not sympathize? Do you not know the discouragement and the frustration and the weariness and the disenchantment and the cynicism that comes from wondering where things are in your relationship with God, what his heart is really like toward you? One author put it this way, those whose Christian lives feel like, some Christian lives feel like they're constantly running up a descending escalator. We find ourselves thinking, how could I mess up that bad again? It is for that increasing suspicion that God's patience with us is wearing thin that stories like this would be written. For those of us who know that God loves us but suspect that we have deeply disappointed him. For those who have told others of the love of Christ yet wonder if he harbors some mild resentment toward us. Sometimes it's because of the frequency of our sin. It's the same thing over and over again. Is God not angry yet? Is he not ticked off yet? Are we still good? And sometimes, I'd say many times, it's the depth of our sin. The skeletons in the closet, the thing that you don't want anybody else to know about, that which most plagues your conscience at night. Is God just merely showing mercy? Or is his heart truly for me? Does he tolerate me or does he treasure me? That's why this story was written. Part one helps you understand the rightness of God in wanting to pour out wrath and stay his good hand. But part two is what actually enables you to revel in his grace. The story does not end with the people's unknown relational status before God. It'll take a dramatic turn. And so, very simply, what we have here, and what you will see in this part two of the people's failure, is the story of God's astounding grace. This is the story of God's astounding grace. I say the story, not a story. This is the story of God's astounding grace in the entire Old Testament. This is the most referenced passage in the remainder of the Old Testament to give us an idea of what God's heart is really like. It's the equivalent of the crucifixion narrative in the New, here in the Old. You haven't seen it yet, but you will. And I want to help you see it the way that they saw it, the way that they read it. By taking you along, switch metaphors here, like a little bit of a drive. Imagine a drive through a national park, and we're going to stop at four different vistas, four different scenic views of God's astounding grace in this journey. I'll give them to you in their kind of like narrative movements, but then we'll unpack them in a way that'll be better for our hearts at the end. But the four main movements of this story of God's astounding grace are relational limbo. That's kind of where things start, relational limbo. And then it goes to intense intercession, followed by legal assurance and reflected reconciliation. I don't intend for you to remember any of that. It just helps me. Notice how this second part of the story starts. Things are still in relational limbo. Those are the verses that we just read. So far, we know that from 33, 1 through 6, that God has said, all right, you guys can go to the promised land. I'm going to send an angel with you. But he made it clear that this angel is not like an angel representing his presence. It's an angel keeping him from destroying him because they get on his nerves so badly. That's what he said. He says, I can't travel with you because I fear that I would break out among you and destroy you all. Now again, I appreciate the transparency of God in communicating to us in written language. For many of us, we hear this and we're like, what? Is God really as like terse and tense and uptight as I am on a drive through the night with my children? Like, don't make me pull this car over. I don't know what's going to happen if I do. Like, is that really the way God acts? No, this is called, here's the fancy word for those of you who like these things, an anthropopathism. Anthropopathism. It is when emotions, pathos, human emotions are ascribed to God to help us understand him. That's why I referenced last week Calvin using the term baby talk. Sometimes God just uses language that we understand. You get that language. God is not as temperamental as you are and you're driving at night with your children. But there is an aspect of him that we get and understand, like his active, aggressive hostility toward rebellion and treason that we resonate with. And so far, we've seen that the children of Israel are like, they're in the danger zone of crossing that relational threshold with God and having him break out against them. He's already punished them some, but right now he said, take off your jewelry. Like, I don't even know what I'm going to do with you. And you even see it here in this passage. He says, look, you can still go to the promised land, but while they're in like the waiting game, because Moses isn't ready to go yet, he tells them they can go, but Moses waits. What we see is that they're stalled out at the foot of the mountain with this other thing called the tent of meeting. Now, don't get that confused with the tabernacle. The tabernacle was supposed to be where? In the middle of the camp. The tabernacle was supposed to be what? A revelation of God's presence with them. But the tent of meeting, where is it? The text says that it's like way out there. It says that everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. It's not God in the midst of them. It's God intentionally stationing his manifest presence outside of them. It's something that they would have to go to. And then notice this. Whenever Moses would go into the tent, like they were, like the people would stand up. Everybody would stand at like the threshold of their own tents, and they would watch and look and see like what's going to happen as Moses talks to God again. Like, will we get back the relational status that we lost? They're looking in anticipation. Moses is the only one who has access. The point of the tabernacle was they were supposed to have representative access. They were going to be allowed into, like, its courtyard. They were going to be able to, like, through these priests, like, sacrifice. They were going to be able to enjoy God's presence. And now it's out there somewhere only through this guy, Moses. And it seems, when we're looking at this particular passage, that the only person who has any real relational credibility with God is Moses, because the text says Moses spoke to him as face-to-face, like as a man speaks to his friend. Again, just more human language for us. The text will later say that no one could see God's face and truly live. They would be incinerated. But, like, relationally, you get it. Like, it's like Moses and God have this intimate relationship. Like, they know one another. They're like, on a first-name basis. Like, Moses has a unique access to God that the others do not have. God meets with him in this tent in some way that is different than the way that he would meet with him in the mountain and different than the way that they would meet with him in the tabernacle. Moses has the relationship that they want. So here they are, like waiting, like wondering, like, okay, are we good or not? And every time they look and see God's presence dwelling in that tent of meeting, and they see Moses going in there, they're wondering how things will turn out for them. And so far, it's only Moses that has this special favor with God. God is still tolerating his people, but now we move to the next scene. We move from relational limbo to intense intercession. Moses is not content to let things dwell the way they are. Now, keep in mind, how are things between Moses and God? They're good. But Moses is a mediator. Moses not only represents God to the people, but bear in mind, he also represents the people to God. He can't help it. That's how God made him. Like, that's what he was forced to be. And therefore, since things aren't right between them and him, they're not right with him and God as well. So notice the language here as Moses appeals for this reconciliation in relationship. Look at verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, 'I know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me your ways, that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. And consider, too, that this nation is your people." Notice how he slips that in there. So Moses is saying, like, I don't understand why you're doing things the way you're doing it. Show me what you're like. Show me how you operate. Have you ever had those types of conversations with people? Somebody's up to something, you don't get it, and you're like, look, can you clue me in? Can you let me know what the game plan is here? That's essentially what Moses is asking. He's saying, look, I really want to know you better because right now I don't understand you in this way, not relating to your people. He says, I'm glad that you and I are good. I'm glad that you think that I have, like, I'm glad to know that I've benefited from your grace. But what about your people? This is effective intercession. Moses is not just saying, all right, it's cool with me. He wants to make sure that his people are good with God as well. And so God responds in verse 14 this way. Notice this. It's careful. Follow it, please, in the text. My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Singular. You. Not y'all. You. What does God say here? Hey, it's all fine. I will go with you. I will be with you in a special way, and I will give you rest. And he's already told the people that they could go ahead and get the place. Like, they're going to be able to, like, live in the land. He's going to fulfill that promise. We saw that last week. But he's not going to live with them in a special relational way. He's only saying this about Moses. Basically, he's like, look, you and I are good. I still am not that good with them. But Moses will not let that go. This is intercession. This is a mediator. Notice how he responds to that. He doesn't just say, all right, that's great. He says in verse 15, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. For how shall it be known that I have found favor in your sight? And now watch this. I and your people. Moses again slips in the people. He's like, I know we're good, but what about them? Basically, Moses is saying, God, respectfully, it's not good with me because I represent these people, your people. We're all one and the same. What about your relational favor to them? Is it not in your going with us so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? So here's how the conversation's going down. Moses and God are talking, and God keeps telling Moses, things are good between me and you. Things are good between me and you. And Moses keeps saying, well, what about them? What about them? What about them? As an effective intercessor, he wants God's relational favor to overflow from him to them. That's how brokering works. It's one thing for your real estate agent to have a nice house. It's something else for you to get one. It is his job not to live in a nice house. It is his job for you to have one. Like, he's an agent. He's a representative of you. Like, he's trying to make sure you have a good place to live. In a similar way, like, Moses is inescapably like the agent of this relationship. And yeah, he represents God to them, but he is not content. He's not content to let it dwell there. He also represents them to him. And this is setting us up for the need for a mediator in the future with God. But this is intense. It goes back and forth. And then look at verse 17. Things begin to escalate. He says, and the Lord said to Moses, this very thing that you have spoken, I will do. So it seems like God's going to relent, like God's going to like accommodate. He's going to bring the people in on relational favor as well. He says, why? For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name. And so Moses like senses the hope in this. He senses the hope for the people. And notice what he says. Please show me your glory. Now, this is a heavy request. We got to understand, like, what is he asking for here? Why does he ask this particular question? If God says, okay, I will also take care of the people as well, Moses wants assurance. Moses wants to know that this is really the way things will go down. So he says, show me your glory. Show me what you're really like. Show me that this is true to who you actually are. The Hebrew word for glory is none other than like kavod. It means literally heaviness or weight. Like it's significance typically. When you talk about the glory of something, you're talking about that which makes it significant. The reason why the Hebrew word for weight is used is because typically a king, if he was a powerful king, had a lot of gold. And you know how you measure gold? You weigh it. The weightiness of a wealthy man is the amount of gold that he has. It's his heaviness. In a similar way, Moses is asking, show me what makes you so significant. I want to know that, like, in this deal that you're making, like, if we are going to move forward, that indeed this is what you're really like. Like, show me your essence. Show me what you're really like. Like, I want to know this in, like, the truest way possible. I am admittedly confused, friends. I do not know. I hate to admit this, but I only have so much time in a week to study stuff. I don't know if Moses is asking for another revelation of God's glory because he's already enjoyed it in so many other ways that he wants to have that relational access again, or if he's asking for an enhanced experience with his glory. But the only thing I can say is that Moses wants to make sure that before he moves forward with this deal, that God really is the kind of person who will remain faithful to his covenant promises with disobedient covenant partners. That's what he's asking. What are you really like? He knows what he is like with guys like him who have represented the covenant better in a more pure way. But he's like, God, what are you really like with the failures? What are you really like with the faltering? What are you really like with the weak? Show me your glory. Let me know your inner heart, your significance, your weight, your worth, like what you're truly like. It is totally for them that he wants to know this. And notice what God says. He says, okay, I will, verse 19, make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord, or Yahweh. And I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for a man shall not see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me where you shall stand on the rock, and while my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of the rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by, and then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen. So God says, okay, I'll show you what I'm really like. We will enter into this special, intimate relationship. You will get to know me in a way that no one else has ever known me before. He says, but I'm going to have to prepare you for it. He says, here's what's going to happen. This will be such an intense revealing of who I am and what I'm like that I'm going to have to hide you in a rock. And then, guess what? We get more of that baby talk. Now instead of anthropopathisms, we have anthropomorphisms, which are this, giving human characteristics to God. So face, back, hands. God is a spirit, friends. He does not have face, hand, or back. But all of these like illustrations, these metaphors, help us understand more of what he's like. This is what he says. In my full relational presence, like, you could not stand it. It would obliterate you. But there are lesser degrees of me that are still true expressions of me. And that's what I will show you. Now, you know this to be true. You can recognize somebody that you love or care for, not just from their face, but from behind, from the back. Or I think of those of you who are car people, it's interesting driving around Naples, especially this time of year, it's November. All the car carriers have made their way back from wherever they come from and dropped off everyone's luxury cars. And so as I like walk through the Publix parking lot, I am astounded as I see my 2012 Hyundai Sonata sitting beside a, and then fill in the blank. I don't want to start listing cars because then I'm going to like mention someone's, but we're talking really nice vehicles. I remember my my relatives came and visited here from Eastern North Carolina, different financial status going on over there, and they had never seen a Bentley before. And in one parking lot, they saw four. Now, did they truly see the Bentley? Yeah, the Bentleys. Yeah, but they didn't exhaustively see them. They saw the back. They could even walk around them and kind of see it from the front. But there's different degrees of experiencing a finer vehicle like that, correct? Like in a few weeks, there will be a car show down on 5th. And what are they going to do? Everyone will take their car, and they're going to park it there. And they're going to open up the hood. They're going to let you see it on the inside. They'll let you sit in it, some of them will. Like you get to explore it to another degree. There's another degree of familiarity with the car. And then there's the next degree. Someone actually allowing you to drive it. There are degrees of familiarity. All I'm trying to illustrate here is that Moses is getting a new degree of intimacy, of familiarity with God. He's not just going to be able to like hear of God. Like there's a difference between seeing a picture of a Bentley and actually seeing one in person. He is actually going to get to see God in a new way, in a special way that no one had ever seen him before. A higher degree of experience is what is happening here. And this is so that his heart would be relieved to know that God truly would walk with, love, stay loyal to failures like the Israelites. So, what did this experience ultimately look like? Well, It will be stayed, it will be moderated according to the verses. But look at chapter 34. Some preparations would need to be made by Moses for this particular event. It says in verse 1, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Cut for yourselves two tablets of stone like the first, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets which you broke. Be ready by the morning and come up in the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain. No one shall come up with you, and let no one be seen throughout all the mountain, and let no flocks or herds graze opposite that mountain.'" And so Moses cut two tablets of stone like the first, and he rose up early in the morning and went up on Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and took in his hand two tablets of stone. And pause here for a moment and just note the preparations. Here's what God says that you need to be ready for this meeting. And this first object should surprise us a little bit. Two tablets of stone. You're thinking like, oh, I thought God was just going to hollow out a stone and put Moses in it. He just needed to go up there. No, this isn't just about like a special parlor trick for Moses' personal enjoyment. Remember, this relational exposure is about like evidencing God's intimacy, not only with the mediator, but with the people he represents. And so what does he tell him to do? He tells him to get two tablets of stone. Two tablets of stone. That sounds familiar, does it not? Like, didn't we like call out some tablets of stone in the story last week? Do you remember? As he came down off the mountain, he took the two tablets of stone, and what'd he do with them? He crushed them. It was the representative of them like ripping up the contract. And what is God going to be doing here in this particular exposure? Like, you don't know exactly yet, but here's what you get. Hey, two fresh tablets of stone. There's relational opportunity in this meeting. Let's see what happens in this one-on-one with God. Bring the two tablets. Make sure that no one else is on the mountain. Make sure that no other animals are around. Clear the mountain like you did the first time in Exodus chapter 24. And we're going to have ourselves a meeting. And in this particular meeting, where God is going to convey like the fullness of what he is like to Moses, especially in his relationship with people who fail and people who falter, what goes down? And this is the high point of Old Testament biblical revelation, friends. Before I read to you these few verses in verses 6 and 7, I just want to remind you in particular that this is one of the most referenced texts in all the Bible to disclose who God is. I read from one scholar here who's done the homework. He said, "Time and time again, the prophets who followed Moses draw on these two verses from Exodus to affirm what he's like." One of these occurs in Lamentations 3:33. Another is Numbers 14:18. Another is Nehemiah 9:17 and 13:22. Another is Psalm 5, Psalm 69, Psalm 86, Psalm 103, Psalm 145, Isaiah 63, Joel 2:13, Jonah 4:2, Nahum 1:3. When the prophets are trying to give people a picture of what God is like in the Old Testament, they come back here. Think about that. If you had only two verses in the Old Testament to show what God was like, where would you go? Genesis 1, Psalm 23. This is where the prophets go. This is where the men who represent God go. You want to know what God is really like, especially in relationship with people who fail and falter. You read verse 6. We'll start in verse 5. "The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord." I don't know what exactly happened, but Moses is in that rock. God shows up in a special way and somehow shields Moses from the full effulgence of his presence. But what stands out is not what Moses sees. This should blow your mind. But what Moses hears. The glory wasn't merely something to be seen. It was primarily something to be heard. It doesn't talk about what he sees, whether there's bright light or what. We don't know. All it says is this, is that the Lord stood there and proclaimed the name of the Lord, like he made his name known in a fresh way. And this verse 6, Yahweh passed before him and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh, the Lord, the Lord. This is who we're talking about, the covenant name of God, his special name. And what is the first thing we learn of God? What is he like? A God merciful and gracious. Not a God irritable and powerful. But the first thing, like when he is explaining what he's really like, what his heart is really like, he is first and foremost merciful and gracious. Not exacting and precise, not disappointed and frustrated. No, keep going. Slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Slow to anger, if you to look at the original, it's kind of a funny word. It means of long nostrils. In Hebrew, the nose is typically the indicator of anger. You can see that, you know, if a guy gets angry, his nostrils flare, but you see it better with like a bull, right? Like, or a horse. Like they start like just like exhaling like through their nose. It's an interesting metaphor. It says that God is of long nose. This isn't something that like he just instantly gets irritated. It says that it's actually something that takes a while. Which I did not notice this on my own. Someone else has pointed it out to me. But when you look through the Old Testament account, like even like the last chapter, God has to be provoked to anger. But his mercy just comes naturally. Isn't it interesting in Hebrews chapter 10, where we're talking about the one another's, it says that believers are supposed to provoke one another to love and good works. Like, we have to be, like, prodded and goaded into love and good works. Not God. He has to be prodded and goaded into anger. Like, his most natural response is love and mercy and compassion and grace. Notice this, that he's not only, not easily angered, but it says that he abounds in steadfast love and faithfulness. Like, these are the words for, like, his special love for people that he enters into relationship with. He just abounds in it. Like, it overflows. It isn't, like, the bare minimum. It is an overflowing fountain, abounding in steadfast love, abounding in faithfulness. Like, he will keep his end of the deal. He will pour out his love. And then verses 7 and 8, or verse 7 in particular, causes much trouble for some. But I want you to notice what you should notice, and that is the first part, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Notice what your God is like. He is one who, like, forgives, like, who offers forgiveness for thousands upon thousands of people, or some translations would put it, thousands and thousands of generations. Like, you just cannot exhaust his love. It's not like he gets tired of it. And it says he forgives, notice this, iniquity and transgression and sin. Friends, that is the trifecta. It is every form of sin imaginable. He hits it from every angle. I know we like to think that God only forgives like the medium-sized sins, but like this one, like he hits it from every angle. He forgives all kinds of sins, any kind that you could possibly imagine. But at the same time, notice this. It says that he also is visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. We already talked about this in Exodus chapter 20. But basically what this is saying is that God enforces the consequences of sin, like multigenerationally. What will happen is a father does something sinfully stupid and it puts the family in a bad situation. Guess what? The kids suffer for that. And sometimes their kids suffer for that. But here's what it says. The natural consequences of sin, still upheld and imposed by God, only last 3 to 4 generations. But what is it that actually is highlighted here? It's the thousands of generations of forgiveness. Like, it's so funny to me, like the things that we choose to criticize about God. Like, we have this whole passage of all this amazing stuff, and we're like, I don't like that one. Like, how ungrateful can we be? Aren't you glad that he actually punishes wrongdoing, especially if the wrong was done against you? Like, this is a good thing. I love how C.S. Lewis said, everybody's a moral relativist till someone steals their orange. Everybody's fine with, you know, like, well, you just do whatever's in your own heart until someone steals your stuff. And then all of a sudden you want somebody to get angry about it. God gets angry about the right stuff, but that is not the emphasis. The emphasis is on his love. This is who he is. This is what he's like. And what does this mean for the people? It says in verse 8, and Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshiped. And he said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, please let the Lord go in the midst of us. For it is, listen to this, a stiff-necked people. And pardon our iniquity and our sin and take us for your inheritance. Why did he need this revelation in particular? Because these people are just terrible. Like us. Stiff-necked. Those animals that wouldn't like submit to the yoke. The hard-headed ones. Like, these are the ones that God shows his love to. He says, God, like, if you are really indeed that gracious and that merciful and that compassionate and that kind, like, good, because we're going to need it. We're going to need it. And so, effective intercession has been made. So they move from relational limbo to effective intercession to legal assurance. And I'm going to do this quickly. Don't worry. I know what time it is. Kind of. Yeah. Chapter 34, verses 10 to 28. I want you to notice how God assures them legally of this relationship. He says, things are good, and this is the way he does it. And he said, behold, I am making a covenant before all your people. I will do marvels such as have not been seen or created in all the earth or in any nation. And all the people among whom you are shall see the work of the Lord, for it is an awesome thing that I will do with you. You know what God is saying, basically? Deal's back on. I'm in. We're good. And he makes it legal. He makes it legal. He's going to take them and he's going to remind them of all the things. He's like, okay, I'm going to do my part. I'm going to follow through. I'm going to bring you to where I said I'd bring you. And at the same time, he summarizes for them the main area of concern as they enter back into this relationship. And here's what it is, so you don't get confused by it. Basically, it's just love me first and in the way that I say. That's it. That's God's number one obligation of them, as simple as I can make it. Love me first and in the way that I say. Now, you're going to see all these commands, but they can be summed up in the first two commandments. He's like, look, this is all I'm asking. Just love me first and in the way that I say. Look at verse 11. We'll read through it quick. Observe what I command you this day. Behold, I will drive out before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and take care lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land to which you go, lest it become a snare in your midst. And you shall tear down their altars and break their pillars and cut down their asherim. That's an idol pole, basically. For you shall worship no other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and when they whore after their gods and sacrifice to their gods, you are invited to eat of his sacrifice, and you take their daughters for your sons, and their daughters whore after their gods, and make your sons whore after their gods. And you shall not make for yourself any gods of cast metal. Pause. There's some strong language. Nobody expected the preacher to say that this morning. And yet it is a disgusting word, the selling of one's body to like provide some type of just like material gain for the individual and for the exchange of the satisfaction of the other. Like he's saying, just don't go sleeping around. Love me first and in the way that I say. Don't have any other ultimates. Friends, it's not that complicated. He's like, don't get sucked in. Like, keep me first. And he's even going to give them some ways that they can do that. Notice, he says, verse 18, positively, you shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, as I command you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt, and all that opened the womb are mine, and all your male livestock, and the firstborn of cow and sheep, and the firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, or if you shall not redeem it, you shall break its neck. and all the firstborn of your sons you shall redeem, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. I'll just pause here and say, he's like, look, you show up to worship at the times that I prescribe and give of your best to me, and that keeps your heart oriented. It keeps your heart oriented around me. I love the way that Jesus put it. People misquote him all the time. Seek you first the kingdom of God, and what? All these things shall be added unto you. And then he gives an explanation. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Now here's the part that we get mixed up. We say, where our heart is, that's where our treasure is. Our treasure will follow. That's not what Jesus said. He said, where your treasure is, your heart follows that. I remember my biological mother buying me at the age of 8 years old some BB&T stock. It was a bank. It's defunct now. I knew zero about the stock market. I think it was a $36 share of stock. At this time, we still looked at newspapers. The only page I typically looked at was the comics. And now all of a sudden, I had an interest in a whole new page, the stock page, because I wanted to know what my stock was doing. I never gave a rip about any of those little numbers and symbols until my money was there. Where my money went, my heart followed. God says proactively, you're going to orient your time and you're going to orient your treasure around me in such a way that it will guard your heart for me. It will keep you from these idols. You invest heavily in my ceremonies, in my revelation, in my prerogatives. And then he says, 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Verse 21. Notice this, like what? These are the laws that he gives. Like, okay, work hard and rest a day? Not bad. In plowing time and in harvest you shall rest. Guess what? Rest every week, even when it's tough. He gives more ceremonies. Like, notice this. He's prescribing, friends, a party. Look at verse 22. You shall observe the Feast of Weeks. You shall observe the Festival of Weeks. So, like, Thanksgiving for us is like a feast week, a festival week. He's like, all right, you're going to do a Feast of Weeks at the beginning, and then you're going to, of the agricultural year. And then notice this one, the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end. Three times in the year, all your males shall appear before the Lord, the God of Israel. And I will cast out nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no one shall covet your land when you go up to appear before the Lord your God three times in the year. And then here's the fun stuff. You shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with anything leavened, or let the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover remain until the morning. And the best of the first fruits of your ground you shall bring to the house of the Lord your God. And the most famous, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. I don't know. You say, Justin, why is this so random? It's not random. It's just a sampling of those first two commands that would keep them oriented around their God. Here it is summarized. Love the Lord your God in the way that he chooses. Love him first and love him in the way that he says. That's the only obligation. They're entering back into the relationship that he is graciously extending to them. And how do they hold up their end of the deal? They just continue to let God do his thing, and then they love him by putting him first and loving him in the way that he says. It's awesome. Time does not allow me to get to the third scene, but I think we've made a decent pass along this journey thus far. I said that there were some movements as we go up the mountain, and as I was just on the Blue Ridge Parkway a few weeks ago, I was reminded that the government has wisely decided to build some scenic viewpoints. They're not that cool at night. You can't see that much, so I didn't get to enjoy them. But you know what it's like. You pull off. You do the little stop off. You've got an overlook point. It'll say you're at 10,000 feet. I wasn't that high. You're at 3,000 feet. You're at 4,000 feet. And they're engineered to help you, like, take in the whole park. Can I just, if you get lost in the details of everything I'm saying today, can I just point out just, like, a couple, like, vistas, a couple of these, like, scenic overlooks into God's astounding grace from this text to help your soul? Just two. The first one is about the mediator, the effective mediator. Friends, I want you to know that they had no hope of fixing this deal on their own. They needed a representative. They needed somebody to fix this for them. And Moses in the Old Covenant was that guy. He did it. He had favor with God, and he brought them in, and guess what? They would keep breaking it, and things would go bad for them. God was merciful, and God was gracious, but according to the New Testament, God sent a better mediator who would better represent the interests of man and who would perfectly represent the interests of God and would bring those two things together so as to secure this relationship forever. I think that some of us think that we're just going to directly fix the brokenness in our lives and somehow clean ourselves up and get into God's good graces. Or some of you have bought into the religious lie that there are certain human individuals who can somehow get you into God's good presence. And I appreciate the clear call out on Roman Catholicism earlier in that vein. There are no human mediators here today who can actually represent you well before God in a way that he'd be satisfied with, and nor is there anyone who actually represents God perfectly to you other than the Lord Jesus Christ. The New Testament says that there is only one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. And that is why Jesus would say, "No man comes unto the Father but by me. I am the way, the truth, the life." Friends, take in the view. You're not cleaning yourself up before God. Somebody else has already fixed it for you. Like somebody's already brokered the deal. Like it's done. Like God is well pleased with him. And because he so truly represents you, he's well pleased with you. Your relationship with God is as strong as the Father's relationship with the Son. It's not about you. Otherwise, you'd be in relational limbo. It's about the effective intercession of the mediator, the go-between, the broker. Take that in. And I would say to those of you who've not yet come to that mediator, just come, like trust him, like have him represent you, and all would be well. So Vista 1, the effective mediator, Vista 2, the heart of God. Oh, friends. The whole point of this long story over four chapters is that where sin abounded, grace abounded all the more. Yes, your sin is terrible. Yes, it breaks the relationship with God. But there's something even greater than that, and it is the all-consuming heart of God, relentlessly pursuing his people in Christ, bringing them into relationship with himself. It is his tendency. It is his native act to actually include. He overflows with love, not merely wrath. When you ask those questions, what does he really think of me? I failed again. Or Justin, you don't know what I've done this week. You don't know what I've done this year. You don't know how bad I've messed it up. You don't know what stupid thing I did. That's typically what we like to call sin these days, stupid. It is not merely stupid, friends. It is sin. It is rebellion against Almighty God, and he absolutely hates it. But listen to this. It is his heart to forgive. It is his heart to include. It is his native disposition to pour out his love to those who would turn to him. Friends, I beg you, and I know we can't do it all in one service, but I just beg you to carefully consider your inherent view of God. I leave you with these words from A.W. Tozer. He says that the most important thing about you is what you believe to be true about God. There's nothing more important about you. There's no better way to know you than to know what you fundamentally believe to be true about God. You believe God's ornery and cantankerous and ticked off? That'll affect your relationship with him and your relationship to others. But you believe that God is fundamentally loving and kind and gracious while still punishing sin, willing to pay for that punishment through the sacrifice of his own son. I mean, like, that is love, astounding, overwhelming. And what does that do for you practically? It brings you in. I love a great reminder I've heard from many parents over the years. There will come a day, you tell your children, where you do the thing that you most hate, that you're most ashamed of, and your number one instinct will be to hide it from me, but the best thing would be to bring it to me. Parents want to fix it. God is fundamentally a father. He knows that you've broken it. He knows that you've messed it up, and it is his heart to remedy, to fix, to heal, to love. And it would be my prayer that as we take in this view, that we would just walk away astounded again by God's grace. Let's pray. Father, give us eyes to see what we cannot. Give us ears to hear what we cannot. Lord, give us feet to walk where we have not. Enable us again by your grace. For those who are not in Christ, may they turn to him. For those who are trusting in him, may they walk faithfully with him, even through their failure, and show that loyal love to him again in the week to come. Astound us by your amazing grace. Amen.